I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're talking all about the new President of the United States of America, Joe Biden, and his administration, joining us to offer a critical perspective on Joe Biden's history as a politician, the special interests like Wall Street and the defense industry that may seek to influence his administration, and more, is Jacobin staff writer and journalist Branko Marcetic, author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. In this conversation, we'll also be addressing the argument that criticisms, however well intended, of the new president and his political history only serves to help the right wing. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now on to the conversation with Branko Marcetic, author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Welcome to Parallax Views, Branko Marcetic of Jacobin and author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. How are you doing, and did I get the name right?
I'm doing well, and you got the name very well. So I'm doing even better than I normally would be. It's always great when someone gets my name right.
So I wanted to have you on the program because I heard you on my friend's show, Joseph Flatley's Field State Update. And you, of course, have been one of the sort of most thoughtful critics on the left of Joe Biden. As I mentioned, you wrote the book Yesterday's Man. Why the title Yesterday's Man?
I wish that I could claim credit for that title. I can't. That was my editor, Jacobin Bhaskar-Sankara, who was a genius, who came up with that name. But I, one of the reasons I think it's a great title for a book is that I think accurately captures who Biden is at this particular moment. He is someone who, even more than the other conservative Democratic candidates who were lined up against Sanders, Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, even more than all them, I think he harkens back to an older time in the Democratic Party. I would say at this point, an archaic and debunked philosophy that really captured the party at his behest. One that kind of engages in this cultural signaling towards blue collar and working class people, at least a conception of blue collar working class people, specifically that kind of Reagan Democrat, the more conservative, you know, people in construction and trades and that kind of thing. But while also pursuing a political agenda that is almost completely at odds with the economic interests of that same crowd, that is who Biden is. He is the Reagan Democrat that so many Democrats have tried to be over the last few decades, really personified. And, you know, depending on what happens in the next few years, perhaps he is the last gasp of that particular political tendency, or perhaps not. We'll have to see, I guess, how this term goes, whether he runs again, whether Trump runs again. A lot of factors at play.
So with regards to Biden in office, have you been surprised so far by anything he's done? I know it's early, or has he sort of met your expectations, or maybe lack thereof?
To begin with, you know, I looked at some of the executive orders that he was doing, and I think this was, in hindsight, really a concerted strategy, media strategy by the administration. But, you know, some of the executive orders went a little further than I would have expected. The particularly the ones in climate were a lot better than I ever would have expected from Biden, especially, you know, given what he had been saying on the campaign trail during the primary, and the terrible rating he got from Greenpeace for his climate plan initially. So that really went further. You know, some of the orders around allowing people to, for instance, decline unsafe work and still get unemployment insurance, I think that's a really huge deal. I think his recent statement on the Amazon union vote, while of course it could have been better and could have gone further, it was still a lot more than I would have expected from it. So there are certain elements of it that I have been pleasantly surprised. At the same time,
real quick, do you think that those elements, maybe there was enough pressure from the left that he had to do those things?
I think definitely on the union, the Amazon union question, I mean, that was something that he got quite a bit of heavy criticism over. It's also something that labor leaders had been engaging with the White House over. So it was something that that was on their radar. And I think probably looking at, you know, the political cost benefit, they thought, yeah, we'll go ahead with it. Which is good. I mean, it was a statement that went further than a lot of previous presidents. But I think that in itself, what I've just said to you, kind of illustrates a dilemma here, which is that in some ways, Biden, in many ways, in fact, Biden has been more progressive and a little bolder than the Obama administration. And that's not surprising. Every Democratic administration, a modern Democratic administration, ends up being a little bit more progressive. We have to remember that this is not just Biden who is running his White House. It is an entire team of Democrats who have been around since the Clinton years and are a part of that apparatus, and will continue to be probably for the foreseeable future, unfortunately. And so it's not surprising to me that that his White House has kind of built on some of the stuff that Obama did, and is a little bit bolder. The problem is that for this historical moment, a little bit bolder than the Obama administration is not what we need. It is the bare minimum that really is necessary, given the scale of the crises that are facing, not just the United States, but the world, not just the pandemic, but climate change, broader ecological destruction, a global depression, global inequality on a massive, massive scale. All these things need far more bold leadership, and Biden has not really delivered on that front. And one example I'm going to give you that I think sums this up is on the $15 minimum wage. Biden has essentially started giving up on it as soon as there was the hint of doubts that it would actually end up passing. He started saying, well, you know what, I don't think it's going to make it. We put it in, but I doubt it. Repeatedly, he has kind of made similar comments in the week since. Essentially, just the other day, accepted when the parliamentarian, this unelected official who kind of rules on these technical quirks, said, no, it can't go in. He said, okay, well, we're giving up on it. Meanwhile, at the same time, they are fighting tooth and nail to get Neera Tanden appointed, someone who is at at least, if not more, jeopardized in terms of voting than the $15 minimum wage. And yet they are not giving up on her. So I think that really shows you that, yes, he's a little bit bolder than the Obama administration, but given how conservative that administration was anyway, you know, it's not going nearly as far as it should be.
If we could, I think one of the things a lot of people on the left talk about when it comes to Joe Biden is this term neoliberalism. And I always like to maybe help define that term for people that are just getting interested in politics, or people who have heard this line that you'll hear every so often in sort of the legacy media that, oh, what neoliberal, that's just a meaningless snarl word, blah, blah, blah. What is neoliberalism and what is Biden's relation to it? Because I think it's a very real thing and a very real problem.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look, of course, neoliberalism is a word that has been overused and thrown around a little too much to the point that its meaning gets blurred. You can say that for any word. Same with fascist. That doesn't mean just because, you know, Ted Cruz, for instance, gets called a fascist, that fascism as a concept does not exist. Neoliberalism, as I would define it, is people usually say it's the kind of small government or the absence of government. Really, it is government policies that are expressly designed, whether that means more government or less of it, expressly designed to privilege business and business interests over everything else. Sometimes that might mean cutting regulations. Sometimes it might even mean anti-monopoly action. Whatever ends up being good for business is generally what neoliberal policy is going to be. And how it relates to Biden is Biden was one of the early neoliberal Democrats. And that is not just me saying it now, 30, 40 years later. That is how the press described him at the time in the 80s. He was someone who was seen as being more aligned with someone like Gary Hart, who maybe people listening to this are not familiar with, but Gary Hart was a socially liberal but fiscally conservative Colorado senator who ran for president a couple of times. He was ultimately done in by a sex scandal because he was having an affair with someone. But Gary Hart was loved by young voters, hated by organized labor because he was seen as hostile to them. And Biden and Gary Hart actually had a very similar AFL-CIO scorecard score through the 80s, one that was markedly low for a Democrat. And so Biden is one of these neoliberal Democrats. He pushed the party, he and the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, the business-friendly, business-backed clique within the Democratic Party that Bill Clinton came out of. During the 80s, they actually toured the country lecturing audiences, Democratic audiences, saying the party needs to change. Reagan's election shows that the old Democratic Party that catered for special interests, quote unquote, I'm doing big quote marks here for people who can't see me, that party has to go and we have to focus instead on the quote unquote middle class. And, we can get into it if you want, but those two terms as used by Biden and that group of people have very, very specific meanings in the context that they were speaking about.
Yeah, I would like to get into that a bit. What do we mean when they say the middle class?
Yeah, well, and they never say this outright. They never come right out and make this absolutely 100% clear. But if you read the various speeches that Biden and the rest were saying, it's very obvious what they were meaning by it. Special interests used to mean lobbyists, big business. That was how it was meant when FDR would call out special interests. And we would talk about the middle class. He would mean the middle class. By the 80s, by the time Reagan comes in, those words start to have a different coded meaning. Special interests, as Biden and some of these other Democrats talked about it, what they meant was the particular interest groups, as they referred to them, that had taken a hold of the Democratic Party. And what those interest groups were basically the at that point, traditional bases of support for the party. So African-Americans, poor people, organized labor in some instances, LGBTQ people, Latinos, immigrants, anyone, any member of the broad dispossessed in the United States that the party had welcomed into its ranks since the New Deal. Basically, they were seen as suspect and sort of seen as corrupting the party, not through their money, but by diverting it away from a winning message. And then what the middle class was, because of course, a lot of these groups that we're talking about were part of the middle class, were and are part of the middle class. But what they were meaning, what Biden was meaning, was a very specific conception of the middle class. And by that, he was thinking of the more conservative, suburban dwelling voter who had become by that point the crux of the Republican Southern strategy, you know, through Nixon right up to Reagan. Those were really the people that were Biden's main constituency in Delaware. That's how he had won, or that's how he had maintained power in Delaware for so many years. And I think he saw it as, you know, this is the model for the rest of the country. Look, Reagan just did it. Clearly, this is the direction we have to go. And, you know, unfortunately, that is basically where the party has moved to over the years, particularly in these last two elections. The party is really, the base is much more diverse, certainly, but it's the party pitches itself to a more middle to upper middle class exclusively demographic than kind of looking for the broad working class that it used to.
What do you think and I know this is maybe going off into a tangent, but what do you think the consequences of that have been? Because I think we're always going to get these commentators that will say, well, you know, we need these suburban voters. They're afraid of socialism. Everyone's afraid of the term socialism. It's good that we've gone in this direction since Clinton. How would you respond to that type of commentary?
Well, I mean, if anyone listening to this or anyone saying that was horrified by the election of Donald Trump, then, you know, then it makes no sense to believe that the strategy was a success. That kind of thinking is exactly what led Trump to end up winning. Because how did Trump win? Mostly he had a iron grip on the Republican base, the typical Republican base, who tend to be more kind of upper middle class and business owners. But he also won enough disaffected Democrats and people who are independents who said, well, you know what? The Democratic Party has not been working for me for decades. I'm going to give this guy a shot who keeps talking about workers and talking about bringing jobs back and taking on the businesses that offshore jobs. And the other way that he did it was that in 2016, the vote was suppressed, the Democratic vote. And I don't mean just by Republican policies. Of course, those exist, and they sadly always will, at least for the foreseeable future. But it was the fact that people just didn't come out to vote in the same numbers that they had for Obama in 2008. It particularly African-Americans and young people, that vote dipped in 2016, because I think those demographics looked at Clinton's campaign. They said, oh, you know, what's the point? Nothing's going to change. And that was a direct result of 8 years of Obama as well, who had followed that sort of strategy that you outlined there. Now, those things changed in 2020. There was a big uptick in young people voting. There was a big uptick in African-American people voting. There was a big uptick in people voting Democratic in general. But question is that a one-time thing because A, Trump was on the ballot, and B, the country was going through a unprecedented cluster of crises that made people come out and gave them the sense of urgency that the candidate themselves didn't? Or was it something that's actually going to be permanent? I would argue it was the former, which is bad news for the future, I think.
Yeah, and I was going to add to that, the sort of Biden neoliberal strategy didn't really work down ballot.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, there are several different reasons why that could have happened. One of the what should be, and I think will be, seen as one of the great unforced blunders of electioneering, the decision to cancel in-person door knocking. The thing that had worked for Obama, that had worked for the Democratic Party for at the very least the last 12 years, they canceled that because of coronavirus, even though there was no scientific basis for it, with a mask and social distancing, still knock on people's doors. And of course, the campaign pushed to keep those primary elections happening on the dates that they were scheduled instead of pushing them back, leading to who knows how many infections, and certainly at the very least some deaths directly. That is incontrovertible. And yet they changed their tune when it came to fighting Trump. And if you look at Democrats at the state level, that is what they will say and have been saying for the last little while. They have been saying that decision was the thing that screwed them over because Republicans went door knocking. But yeah, as you say, it has not been necessarily a strategy that has been that good for the party overall. And again, if you look at the history of those kinds of candidates, the candidates that offer something that is a few degrees away from the Republican alternative, those candidates have had a very bad track record for the last 40 years. Biden this year last year has been an exception, but that year was a tremendously exceptional year given the horror and destruction that was visited upon the country because of Trump's mismanagement of the pandemic response. And even then, Trump barely lost, which is something that people continue to refuse to acknowledge or face up to. Biden essentially won by a few fractions of a percentage of a vote in a few key states. Otherwise, Trump could have easily been gone to a second term despite all the terrible things he had done.
So we were talking earlier about Biden and labor. What is Joe Biden's relationship to organized labor? I know that people will say the AFL-CIO endorsed him in 2020. So what is his relationship? Because I think it's more complex than just saying, oh, well, the AFL-CIO supported him, so he's great for labor. I don't think it's that simple.
Yeah, oddly, Biden has this very strange relationship with labor, which it's a good one. I mean, they like him, but they like him in spite of the fact that he has ritually betrayed them for decades. It's one of these examples of the kind of thing I was talking about at the beginning, where Biden has this kind of cultural signaling he does. It's sort of, you might think of it as kind of like blue collar identity politics, where he will say things, you know, he'll say, I'm a union man from belt buckle to shoe sole. Or he'll say, you know, well, you know what, it was unions that built this country and unions that built the middle class and not the 1%, not Wall Street, not these guys at Wall Street. Whereas in reality, I mean, one of Biden's core constituencies, not just in this recent election, but throughout his career, has been those guys in Wall Street. It has been the business community. And even though Biden has done things like repeatedly vote against union interests and union desires and things like the balanced budget amendment or Reagan's line item veto or cutting entitlements or, you know, perhaps most notably on things like NAFTA in the early 90s and permanent trade relations with China, both things that were opposed by his union supporters. In spite of this, unions like him because I think he has this kind of retail politician backslapping style that I guess papers over that. In many ways, he's kind of the last of that kind of politician who's able to kind of translate his personal affability into votes despite of what he does. I mean, we should remember that back in 2015, when Biden was actually considering a run that year against Hillary Clinton, Richard Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, actually he dragged his feet on endorsing Clinton or giving her his backing because he was waiting to see if Biden was going to throw in. And he actually kind of used that as a bit of a bargaining chip, basically saying, well, you know, if Biden comes in, you know, we're not necessarily going to have a clear choice on who to support. So, yeah, he's supported by Labour, but it's very mystifying why, given his actual record.
Could you give a few examples of his record that are particularly telling in regards to either special interests or moments where he hasn't always been pro-labor?
Well, yeah. I mean, a great one, probably the example, is the bankruptcy bill that Biden championed and ultimately passed only when there was a Republican administration in office. Biden's bankruptcy bill essentially made it means-tested bankruptcy. And so for a whole host of middle-class people, bankruptcy suddenly became a lot harder. Expunging the debts became a lot harder. It also added all these kind of onerous requirements onto people who were going through bankruptcy. They had to go through these, you know, financial literacy courses and all sorts of other kind of stuff. The stuff that people did not know when they would enter into bankruptcy, and that would inadvertently doom their filing. The judges hated this law. Bankruptcy judges. There was one who called it, you know, he said something like it was the worst law that he had ever seen that he had to deal with. And it was done nakedly on behest of a whole host of banks and credit card companies, but one in particular, MBNA, which was headquartered in Delaware. It was Biden's biggest political donor through his entire career. His son ended up being hired by them in a well-paying position. They even kept him on retainer once he left the company. An executive from MBNA actually bought Biden's house for twice the value that Biden had bought it for. Market value, but nonetheless pretty unseemly. And of course, all of this was a huge scandal. And it was the reason why Elizabeth Warren actually had got into politics. She memorably testified in front of Biden and had a very testy exchange with him over this. Of course, Warren did not bring any of this up during the primaries at any point. For whatever reason. But I think that is one of the clearest examples of one, something that that expressly hurt the middle class people that Biden claims to speak for, and that of course unions had helped to build, but also was done at the behest of a special interest, a credit card company that had given money to Biden, huge numbers. Other things that Biden has done, I mean, particularly in Delaware. Delaware is known as the corporate state. It's essentially a tax haven, and its entire economy is based around creating a favorable legal landscape for corporations, whether it's for taxes or for bankruptcy. And Biden played a big part in that, in voting for these things to basically make things more corporate friendly in Delaware over the years. And of course, he was rewarded for it, naturally. I could go on. I mean, there's examples, for instance, Biden, just at the moment that he was becoming a fiscal conservative in the late 70s and the early 80s, and after winning his initial election on a more economically populist platform while relying on small dollar donations, by that point into the 80s, he was getting money from a lot of big developers and finance people and other business people. I think that this is not why it happened, but it's not a coincidence that at the same time he had become really basically turned towards more Reaganite vision of economic policy. Those are a few other examples, but there are countless others where Biden has kind of done the bidding of people who have given him money.
Could we talk a little bit about specific special interests or elements that may be seeking right now to influence policy with regards to the Biden presidency, the Biden administration?
Yeah, I think one is Wall Street, which is no surprise. I mean, look, The house always wins. And in the United States, the house is the financial sector. They calibrate their donations based on who they think is going to win anyway. But they make sure that they have inroads into every single, and into both parties. I mean, obviously, Trump, after running this campaign on against globalism and banks and all this other kind of stuff, ended up just putting those exact people into his administration. And Biden's no different. You know, after running this kind of populist campaign about the working man and, you know, Wall Street didn't build this country, well, he got more money than Obama did from Wall Street, ultimately. Not quite as much as Clinton, but I think $74 million or something along those lines. And we've seen now, I mean, he's stacked his administration with people from the financial sector, including Brian Deese, one of his top economic advisors, who was an executive at BlackRock. So that's one example. Another example, and I think a really important one, is the healthcare sector. Biden, during the primary, was the top recipient of money from the healthcare sector, not just health insurers and hospitals, but pharmaceuticals. That really continued into the general campaign, although Trump also got a lot of donations, a lot of money from those same quarters. Let's be clear about that. But they did favor Biden. And what are we seeing now? When was the last time that you heard Biden talk about his public option? I don't know if anyone listening to this remembers, but during the primary, when Sanders was running on Medicare for All, and really that was the entire primary revolved around that, whether you were for Medicare for All or against it. Biden's alternative was the public option, which was the thing that Obama had run on in 2008. And then he basically jettisoned in a secret deal with the healthcare sector, in a backroom deal, say, hey, if you support my healthcare reform, we'll get rid of this thing that threatens your profits. Similarly, Biden, the entire time, is championing the public option, and he is getting tons of money from the exact same sectors that killed the public option the first time when Obama was president. And lo and behold, what happens? He gets elected. I don't think I've heard him talk about the public option for months at the very least. The thing he's now pushing is government subsidies for people to buy private insurance, essentially incredibly wasteful for one, but basically funneling money to people to get them to keep giving money to the healthcare sector, to the health insurance sector. And by the way, some of those donors that were pushing that exact idea, some of those companies that were pushing that idea, are also the same ones that donated to him for his inauguration. As inauguration day festivities. So, you know, I think those are two really, really clear and key examples of what you're talking about there.
You mentioned BlackRock real briefly there. It seems like certain people that were involved with BlackRock are popping up on the Biden team. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, BlackRock is the largest asset manager in the world. It's interesting, actually, because I think in previous administrations, it was Goldman Sachs that was the big winner that they would draw from for staffing. That has not happened this time, but you know, it's still the financial sector. So now it's a different part of the financial sector. BlackRock is a company its aim is to make as much money as possible. And to do that, it invests in a variety of terrible industries. I think for me, the most alarming element of it is that BlackRock is a key investor and funder in the supply chains that are basically destroying the Amazon rainforest, and have been for years, but particularly escalated under the Bolsonaro regime there. And, maybe people listening to this go, well, you know, whatever, it's a rainforest, you know, I don't care about some trees and animals, but that's not that important to me. Well, even if you think that, I mean, there is a very good reason the Amazon rainforest should be important to you, because it is on the precipice of reaching a tipping point where it will start to simply die out. Once that happens, you get not only do we lose potential access to all kinds of medicines and and so much else that remained undiscovered that we've gone from that ecosystem. But it will send a massive amount of carbon into the atmosphere, potentially leading to runaway climate change, which I don't even want to dwell on right now. Essentially, to prevent this kind of thing, one of the things you have to do is you have to rein in the financial sector that is investing in these supply chains, that is actually fueling this destruction of the Amazon. I think if you have a administration that is staffed with people, not just from the financial sector, but specifically from that company that has been singled out as one of the worst fuelers of Amazon deforestation, the chances of that happening are very unlikely to me. And this is, by the way, this is one of the things that Biden campaigned on. To his credit, he was the only one that I heard anyway during the primary talking about the need to prevent Amazon deforestation. Well, he's put people who were directly responsible for that deforestation to advise him on economics. So, hopefully we'll get through the next 4 years. But then, the question is what comes after that? If it's just 4 more years of Biden is the best option, then, that is not a very good situation that we're going to be in.
And I was going to add to that, the Biden's top economic advisor, you pointed out, is Brian Deese, but that's not the only BlackRock veteran that's involved with the administration, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I cannot, off the top of my head right now, name you all the others, but there are several others that he's named as top economic people. There was actually someone, this is not BlackRock, but there was someone just today, a former executive of Blackstone, which is another horrible, horrible company that has been welcomed into his administration. It's not as if this is the exclusive source of his appointments, but I think given the significance of some of these economic appointments that they've come from BlackRock, I think it shows the company has quite a bit of influence. And I'm sure a lot of these people, when they leave government, where are they going to go? I'd be surprised if they did not go back home.
The old revolving door, right?
Yep, exactly.
So another area that's really important for me to get into, one of the ones I focus on the most, is foreign policy. So what is Biden's relationship to what's been called the military-industrial complex? You've written a really great article about this, by the way. The Biden era is witnessing a return of the military-industrial complex. Let's get into that.
Yeah, all credit to that goes to the Revolving Door Project that compiled this really great, impressive report that showed this think tank, the Center for a New American Security, which is kind of like a liberal think tank, a foreign policy version of the Center for American Progress, that was essentially, it's meant to be a Democratic administration in waiting, similar to CAP, and except in foreign policy. It was originally created to revolve around Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008. When Obama won, they were seamlessly integrated into that administration, and they really helped to staff and then run the foreign policy for Obama with the results that we saw. And that same think tank is now obviously it's been drawn on for Biden's administration. And as this report by the Revolving Door Project shows, they have a history of basically taking money from weapons manufacturers and other interests, private military contractors, for instance, and then producing papers, that essentially argue for the interests of those exact companies. For example, saying yes, we should use more private military contractors in Afghanistan. That's a good idea. The reports outline several examples of this, and the Center for New American Security is not the only one who does this. This is sadly a pretty common feature of the think tank scene in DC, where they take money from huge corporations and wealthy people, and they end up just kind of tailoring their message to suit that, especially in foreign policy. But what is interesting is that the amount of people, I think it's like 13 of Biden's appointments on foreign policy have actually come from that think tank, from the CNAS. And actually, she did not end up getting in here, but Michelle Flournoy, who was briefly considered for Secretary of Defense, she was someone who founded the CNAS. And ultimately, that kind of swampy nature of the think tank and her ended up undermining her bid to get that position. But ultimately, you know, look, the think tank is still clearly wielding influence within the administration.
For my listeners, what would that mean for foreign policy? Does that mean that maybe we can expect a more hawkish foreign policy? Because I always like to really hone in on that, because there's so much money that comes from the taxpayers that could be spent on infrastructure at home, but ultimately gets spent on these forever wars, which even Biden has said, oh, we need to end the forever wars. But I'm wondering, when you have all these people involved from the Center for New American Security, are we really going to see an end to all that?
Yeah, these are liberal interventionists. These are people who really share a philosophy with the neoconservatives of the world. It's just it's a little bit, a few degrees to the liberal side, but ultimately it's the same thing.
I want to add something real quick there. I was going to say, I don't know if I'm the only one that thought this, but when I heard Center for a New American Security, I thought to myself, that sounds like, what was that neocon think tank called? The Project for a New American Century. It reminded me of that a bit. So, but I didn't mean to interrupt. Go on.
No. Well, I think that's a really good point, because I think it speaks to the overlap in ideology here, because even though there's a few degrees of difference there, ultimately what they share is this belief that American power is infinite, and then secondly can be used to sort of reshape the world in ways that that one, suit U.S. interests, and two, that are kind of predictable and manageable and controllable. You know, of course, this is the ridiculous idea that led Bush to first invade Iraq and Afghanistan with disastrous results, some of which we are still living with now. And then later led Obama to intervene in Libya with similarly disastrous results. And though they would justify it a little bit differently, ultimately they both believe this idea that the U.S. not just has a right but a duty to intervene in the world and to prevent bad things from happening. Of course, certain bad things. In each of these cases, neocons, all these more liberal interventionist people, they're perfectly happy to let certain bad things keep happening if it suits their interests. I think we saw that most recently with Biden's decision to not really do anything significant to penalize the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. Again, perfectly happy to live with certain terrible things and despotism if it's considered too hard or inconvenient.
I'm glad that you mentioned Khashoggi, because recently someone who I would say isn't necessarily as left-wing as you or I or associated with the left, Jake Tapper, recently criticized Biden in regards to Saudi Arabia and Khashoggi, and I've seen him get a lot of pushback from these, I guess, quote-unquote moderate Democrats, and they're saying things like, well, this is just the beginning of his administration. Do you want Trump to win in 4 years if he runs again? I'm curious, how would you respond to those sort of criticisms that are now even being lobbied at someone like Jake Tapper? Because there is this line that is always thrown out, oh, well, the Republicans will win if you criticize the new Democratic president at all.
First of all, it's repugnant and authoritarian. The idea that you should refrain from criticizing a politician for doing bad things because you don't want to ruin their chances. Well, okay, well, I mean, why even have a free press? I mean,
means you can't apply pressure to a new president, and that's really bad because forces on the right are going to be applying pressure to this same president. If we don't, someone else will.
Yeah, so that was going to be my second point, which is even if your only concern is not, you know, preventing bad things from happening, but or speaking truth to power, but stopping another Trump term. I mean, refraining from criticizing Biden and his administration is exactly the thing that will lead to another Trump. Because as you say, one, the only pressure he's going to get is from the right. And if there's one thing that you can say about Biden, and one thing I can definitely say from having looked at his career for 40 some years, is that he buckles under pressure from the right very, very easily. And so if there isn't anything counterweighing that, I think he's always going to be more friendly or more inclined to surrender to them anyway. But if there's nothing happening from the other side, then he absolutely has no reason to resist any of it in even the mildest way. And secondly, I mean, you should be pushing the administration to live up to its promises. You should be pushing it to do better, because if all he does for 4 years is accept a bunch of the changes that Trump did on, say, immigration, if he ends up doing things like actually reversing some of the few good things, in my opinion, that Trump did on foreign policy, which is to start to get out of some of these wars, that leaves him wide open for exactly the kind of defeat that Hillary Clinton suffered in 2016, where you have the Democratic vote suppressed, and you have other people go, well, you know what, this guy, yeah, I mean, I was fine to vote for him in 2020 because of how terrible Trump was and how terrible things were going. But you know what, he hasn't really done such a hot job since. So you know what, I'm going to go for the other guy, whoever that might be. So if you want to prevent another Trump term, or prevent another Republican resurgence, you should actually pressure and criticize the administration for not living up to its promises on the minimum wage, on so many other things, on climate, on immigration, all these things that they're going to factor into the next election.
Do you have a few extra minutes? Could I keep you over?
Sure.
Okay. So with regards to, you said that Biden has buckled under the right before, and it seemed like you put emphasis on that. Do you think Biden has done this even more than maybe some of the other Democrats that are sort of associated with the DLC and whatnot? Is there something extraordinary about Biden in regards to that?
I mean, I don't know if there's anything extraordinary about him or particularly unique there. I mean, that is a feature that is common to a lot of Democrats of that generation who saw Reagan's victory and went, oh, you know what? Politics has changed. We have to – there's just no way we can do the kinds of things that we were doing before. We have to adhere to a vision that's closer to where Reagan is and the rest of the Republicans. That's the way the politics is now. It's too bad, but if we want to maintain some of these things that we built during the New Deal, that's what we have to do. I think what is unique about Biden is that, let me give you an example. Chuck Schumer, there's an element of it where he is obviously looking at his left flank and looking at a possible primary challenge. But I think he also has taken some of the lessons of the past few years and gone, actually, you know what? We do have to deliver things for people if we want to be able to if I want to be able to just keep my seat, which is ultimately what these people, what their main priority is. They go, okay, I get it. Things have changed. And you know, they were purely just cynically playing to politics. With Biden, I think he very, very early on learned the lesson that if you are getting pushback from the right, that the way to win is to move closer to them and do what they say. He would maybe frame it differently. He might say, you know, you sort of steal the issue from them. The example I'll give you is in 1975. He's 3 years into his first term. Again, he had won on a fairly liberal kind of campaign and platform, surprisingly so for who he would become. And by 75, there's this massive furor around busing in Delaware, which I don't know if I should go into what busing was, but let's just say it was a racial justice measure, an integration measure, school integration measure, that got a lot of white families at that time riled up, supposedly because of the inconvenience, and there was an element of that, but also it was heavily linked to racial animus. Anyway, big controversy. Biden had kind of tried to avoid the issue, but he had voted for busing basically consistently in his first 3 years. But by 75, when there's this massive controversy, a court order ordering it in Wilmington, Delaware, he starts getting tons of pushback from people. And people, you know, going to his office and people saying they're going to primary him and all this other kind of stuff. And he suddenly becomes this virulently anti-busing Democrat. I mean, you know, not just voting consistently against busing for the next 3 years, but also saying things that really in now, when you look at it, are quite horrendous. Like, you know, things that are on the line of being pretty discriminatory and offensive. And he's doing it because he sees what's happening in 78. And it's the same thing. He moves on economic policy, I think in large part because he sees things like the Taxpayers' Rebellion in California that kind of ignites similar movements and similar amendments across the country. And he goes, oh, this is where the country's moving. I have to also turn sharply right. And he starts saying, well, actually, I'm a fiscal conservative. Look how much I've been cutting from the government. And, you know, he puts forward a bill that essentially would have ended every federal program automatically after, I think, 5 years, if it wasn't manually reauthorized every single time by Congress, which is insane. That's the kind of bill he puts forward. He points to it and he says, he says, I see that the mood in the country is changing. And as I see it, my job is to move in that direction. Now, the other thing I would say is that at the same time that he essentially surrenders to pressure from the right on these issues, you know, he's also getting pressure from more liberal groups. He gets pressure from civil rights organizations. He gets pressure also from women's groups who are disappointed with his stance on access to abortion and you know, reproductive rights in general. And he does not buckle to that pressure in the same way. He is actually very resistant and he's very proud of it. So there is a real instinctual conservatism within Biden. I think he is cynical. He has been cynical. But I think he's also instinctually kind of inclined towards the more conservative end, which is why I think, you know, to some extent, it's remarkable what has been able to be pulled out of him in his first, less than 2 months as president. But it's also not enough. It's not nearly enough for where we're at this current period. So, yeah.
I guess before closing out, that brings up, can we pressure Biden? Can the left pressure Biden? Do you see hope in that prospect?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The left is never going to get everything it wants from Biden. It's just not going to happen. He is going to betray the people that voted for him. He already has. He already is. But it's not to say that some things are not possible. I mean, like the Michelle Flournoy example is a really good one. There have been other appointments. Gina Raimondo, for instance, the governor of Rhode Island, she was going to be the human health services secretary. Ultimately, Biden decided not to appoint her because there was quite a bit of firestorm, quite a bit of outrage and criticism of that idea. So I think that is an example where he can be pushed. The Amazon union statement, I think, was an example of this kind of pressure. I think it needs to be a lot bigger, though. I think a lot of the people who are the kind of people you were describing, the people who go, oh, well, let's just not say anything about him. Let's just let him do his job. We want him to win. You know, ask yourself, how well did that work in Obama's first term? What happened there? I mean, with everyone basically just surrendering and saying, let's just let him do his job, Obama ended up doing, one, not nearly going far enough, and then two, doing some things that were actively hostile to the interests of not just the party's base, but working people in general. And he was punished for it in the midterms. And that midterm shellacking, as Obama talked about it, ended up being basically the death knell of his presidency. For the rest of his 6 years, he couldn't do anything because he didn't have Congress inside. And that will happen to Biden as well. If things like the minimum wage, the $15 minimum wage do not pass, and if he, you know, God forbid, but I do foresee this happening, if he does something like embark on a deficit cutting grand bargain, a sort of Obama sequel with the Republicans, and tries to do some sort of means testing of Social Security, which he in 2017 kind of hinted he would do. You know, those are things that I think can, but more importantly, have to be defeated. You know, whether that happens, I can only hope. We'll have to see.
Closing out here, the one thing I've always notice about Biden and some of his biggest boosters in the media is this sort of rhetoric of we're going to return to normal. I think in a recent speech he said America is back, where, you know, I don't know what necessarily those vague statements mean, and they're probably deliberately vague for that reason because you can project onto them. Could you talk a little bit to that sort of language that Biden uses, and maybe what does he mean by things like America is back or the return to normal?
I think what he means, and what a lot of people take that phrase to mean, is that after 4 years of a administration that was unprecedentedly malevolent and dangerous and authoritarian and right-wing and all this other kind of stuff, that we've gone back to the safe normal, that the nice okay course that things are on under Obama. I think that is what people generally think. But I mean, the truth is that I think really what people are thinking of is I'm looking forward to not feeling like I have to be politically engaged or read the news or be upset by the news anymore. I mean, the fact is that Trump did some unprecedentedly terrible things, for sure. And also he did terrible things that were not unprecedented, that were just sort of regular Republican things. The difference was in how his administration was treated. I mean, the stuff he did was very much in line with what every Republican president had done in the decades before him, and to be honest, was very much in line with what Democratic presidents had done. I mean, there's a very logical and not particularly sharp difference, you know, the continuity between, say, Bill Clinton and Bush and Obama to Trump's immigration policy. You know, I think that's one of the key examples. The difference was that this time, whereas people didn't really care about immigration when it was Obama. When Obama was deporting people, separating families and doing all this kind of stuff, it just wasn't covered in the same way. It wasn't covered in this pitched, you know, hyper-alarmist way that Trump was. And I think it should have been covered in the same way that Trump was, but it wasn't. And I think that's what people are looking forward to. Because, look, Biden already has – he is basically continuing a lot of stuff that Trump did that people were saying was white supremacy and fascism when Trump was in power. Now that Biden's doing it, it's crickets. People are actually defending his reopening of the migrant child detention facility. They're saying, well, look, it's quite good, actually. I mean, that was the exact opposite under Trump. So, yeah, I think that's really what it is people just they for 4 years were they were consuming the news more often, and they were being very alarmed by the news. And now they're kind of looking forward to just switching off and relaxing and not thinking about it. Going to, back to brunch, as so many people have said. But I would remind people that the normal that they are returning to, the Obama-era normal, is a thing that directly led to Trump. And so this idea that things were totally fine, even though, you know, there was a global financial crisis and the world had gone to hell and there was a president who was unilaterally killing people around the world, including American citizens, that's not normal. And if that's the kind of normality you want to return to and you think it's fine, even if you don't take my word for it, just look at what happened in 2016 if you want to see why that does not make any sense.
The only thing I would add to that is I've already seen some commentators and some people tweet, you know, at least when Biden drones some country, you know, at least he doesn't make mean tweets about it. I mean, the people pushing this kind of stuff, they're not talking about policy. The return to normal, America is back. These are not issues of policy. It's an obsession with artificial appearances. And yeah. I think that's going to lead to very bad things in the future, especially because if you don't like Trump, well, he's not going away. And he seems to really have taken over the Republican Party.
It is about culture and emotion. And that is ultimately what politics at the moment is kind of retreating to. Not completely. I think Bernie Sanders' two campaigns really did activate something new in people. I think really gave people kind of an alternative vision, even if he ultimately fell short. But for a lot of people, particularly people who are media commentators, people who work in the press, specifically the kind of political press, I think it's mostly a thing about feelings and presentation and manners and you know, not so much about the actual nuts and bolts of what's happening, sadly.
So I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If you could, how can my listeners keep up with your work, and what's the best way to get a copy of Yesterday's Man?
All good questions. You can find me on Twitter at B Marchetich, it's just my name, but I've put H's after the C's to help people understand how to pronounce it. You can find me at Jacobin. You can find me at In These Times as well, a great Chicago-based magazine that I write for occasionally. If you want to get Yesterday's Man, you can buy it from Verso on their store. It's in its second print now, I believe. Also, you may be able to find it in stores here and there physically. That I don't really know. I've seen it, or at least I've been sent pictures of it, so it probably exists, but I cannot tell you where you can actually physically go to get it.
Well, thank you again, Branko, for coming on Parallax Views.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Branko Marchetich, author of, again, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Be sure to check out his work at Jackman Magazine and In These Times. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time,
You've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.